Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And good morning, and the sun streaming through the windows.
Showing all the dirt. But we're getting ready for spring, so we're going to have them spring clean very soon. And what better time than springtime to say today is declared to be Ladies' Day on the Menu Radio. Three ladies who are in different parts of the dining and wining business, but
all strong, all successful.
All absolutely at the top of their game. First of all, Elizabeth Faulkner from Citizen Cake and Orson in San Francisco, and we caught up with her at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. Then a wonderful, wonderful cookery school owner and author, Darina Allen, all the way from Ireland. And finally, and by no means least, Barney Old, who just produced a wonderful new book all about wine, and we talked a lot about wine and about the book. So that's the composition of today's program. We hope you'll enjoy, and let's get it on the road.
Charleston, South Carolina is apparently becoming a major crossroads of the United States, because here at the Food and Wine Festival, we encountered one of our favorite people, pastry chef, restaurateur, and a bunch of other things, cookbook author, and so forth, Elizabeth Faulkner, welcomed on the menu yet again.
I know, thank you so much.
Yeah.
So exciting to bump into you here.
Yeah, and now you said this was the first time you were at Charleston Food and Wine Festival. Is the first time you've ever been in Charleston?
First time in Charleston. And well, 2 years ago I went to New Orleans for the first time and sort of fell in love with all the food stuff there.
Isn't that fabulous?
Yeah, and now I'm just like, I'm just kind of more obsessed with all of the ingredients from
this area. Are you going to New Orleans again?
I will go to New Orleans in a heartbeat.
Because we're supposed to be there in May for the Nowfee event.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, any excuse I can have go to a place like New Orleans.
Christmas there, we like them so much.
Mm.
Anyhow, run us through your operations. I mean, Citizen Cake is a given, and you're moving it.
Citizen Cake, you know, I've had that since 1997.
Ooh, it's been that long, huh?
I know, and I moved it from its original location a couple years into it to Hayes Valley. We were there for 10 years, and now I'm moving it over to Fillmore Street. And we're right in the middle of that right now. We just moved everything
out
last weekend. Yeah, very exciting location, right on Fillmore between California and Sacramento, where Vivendi was for years. And so it just has a really good feeling. It's a little bit smaller, and we're going to have about 40 seats.
Sounds perfect size-wise.
Yeah.
And then tell me about Orson.
Orson is a really fun restaurant, too, because I just opened that 2 years ago, pretty much exactly 2 years ago. And it allowed me, I mean, because of the name Citizen Cake, and even though we've always been a patisserie and restaurant, and people know me for my desserts, and I love doing dessert, but it really allowed me to sort of make a statement in on the savory or culinary side. And I think it's just a really cool, it's a huge restaurant, and it's a big endeavor because we opened it right when the market crashed. And so it's just been tough, but also people are... It's kind of found its groove, and people really like it, and it's kind of an up-and-coming area still.
And there was a reason for the name, right?
Well, the Citizen Cake name came originally because I used to have a signature dessert at Rubicon called Rose Petal Creme Brulee. So naturally, when I thought of the name Citizen Cake, a cake for every citizen, and Rosebud could be part of that as a dessert, and then wanting to link it together to the names together, and then you don't really hear the name Orson very often, and so it just felt like a very iconic and strong name.
Yeah, well, I'm excited because we're swearing to come there next time we're in San Fran.
Great.
Just give our listeners an idea of have been your duties here as an invited guest chef. What have you been doing?
Oh, wow. I got to cook at a dinner last night with Barbara Lynch, who's a great friend of mine, and Michelle Bernstein, another great friend of mine, and Michelle Lever here from Charleston Grill, and just a really fun, and the pastry chef also, Emily Cookson from Charleston Grill. And I have to say, the kitchen at Charleston Place has just been great. Everybody's been extremely helpful, gave me a lot of space, you know,
That's a nice kitchen, isn't it?
Very nice kitchen. And so I prepped everything for one whole day. Came in yesterday, did the dessert for the dinner, and it's always fun to do these kind of dinners for, you know, 50 people or something.
Yeah.
And then I'm doing the big Bubbles and Sweets dessert event tonight.
That's tonight.
Yeah,
if we can stay awake.
you'll be able to tell just exactly how hardy party we are, whether we make that event or not.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, how many of these events do you do?
Well, I mean, it kind of just depends. I've been... I've done the South Beach Food and Wine Festival before. I've done the Masters and then Pebble Beach. I haven't actually been to Aspen yet. I was talking to Gail Simmons the other day, and I said, you know, I've never actually been to Aspen.
We've never actually been there. That must be huge.
It sounds like a pretty fun one. But I like doing these kind of events or charity events in different places just so I can see. It's like a really good way for me to learn about people and the cuisine in different areas, wherever it is, if it's in this country or another country.
As you're saying, I mean, you have a bit of you that's Southern. But you really are interested in the ingredients now.
Very interested in all the ingredients.
Yeah.
I mean, I think like most chefs, we're always kind of on an expedition to look for new ingredients and new techniques. And so,
have you landed Australian finger limes yet?
I've had those before. And you know what's funny? I had some at a restaurant in San Francisco called SPQR.
Okay.
The chef there, Matt, had a little dish with some of the finger limes.
Because you can't import them. They're growing them in California.
Yeah.
But the FDA
doesn't allow import yet.
That was Nate Appelman's restaurant, right? We were there.
We
were there.
They have a new chef, though.
I mean, he's gone. I don't know. Yeah.
Matt Accarini and Shelley Lindgren and still has a great wine program there. It's one of my favorite restaurants in San Francisco. I think it's the best it's ever been now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, we had a great time there, and Nate told us he was opening a restaurant in Japan, and everything was on a roll, and then all of a sudden he was in New York looking for a job.
All of a sudden he was making pizza, which is even funnier. Now, we want to talk to something very, very dear to my heart. Is you are on the board of Women Chefs and Restaurateurs, and that was my old favorite organization. Through some ups and downs, mainly ups and then some downs, and then I left it.
Mm-hmm.
But you are in a position where you were part of a revival. I want to know all about that. What exactly are you doing? How are you going about this? It's a very important organization. Is the mission the same?
I think it's a very important organization because we're constantly, as chefs in this business, I constantly am being interviewed about what it's like to be a woman versus in a male-dominated industry. And I'd say that also I've been talking to some other chefs here. I was talking to Gabrielle Hamilton last night about this, and I said we have an opportunity to go into WCR. I feel like WCR is definitely, like you say, it's gone through some ups and downs. I believe now it's a very fiscally responsible organization. And also I'm just tired of it being a little bit kind of like old-fashioned. I want WCR for younger chefs to be able to come in, learn some stuff. Absolutely, their education is part of it, but also just to be a badass chef. You know, we party like the guys do too. So
but that worked when it was on the West Coast. It was when it started going around to some of these other things like Louisville, Kentucky, and stuff that didn't carry well at all. Its first meeting, you know, was really in New York City.
That's right. Yeah. And I mean, I know that it was a few chefs, women chefs, who wanted to get together and actually really help educate and bring up the women in the business and be supportive.
But the only place where there really was a critical mass, as they say, I hate that expression, of executive women chefs and restaurateurs was San Francisco. I mean, not even in New York,
mm-hmm.
were they as prominent. And I think that's how it got shifted. So what all are you doing? Tell me in specific.
Well, I'm new on the board, and we had our first meeting this year in January at Google, in the Bay Area. And Virginia Willis, who's from Atlanta, she was there too, and she's new also. And, you know, we had a great conference last year in Washington, D.C., and it just felt like the camaraderie was sort of really uplifting again. It felt like, you know, because I've been a member of WCR since it started, and I was in my 20s when it started, so I feel like I'm at a point where I really enjoy seeing all these women chefs who are just amazing cooks, you know, and they're all my idols, you know, they always have been. And so getting everybody together and really just having a fun time. I think we have to remember that it's supposed to be fun.
Oh, we had a ball. Oh, we just loved it. In fact, we were in D.C. For at least one, maybe two meetings, I think.
Yeah.
We were, yes.
Where can people find out about what's going on so they can recognize it as something that they want to join and do?
Well, we have a website, you know, and we have all
updated?
Different. I think it's still actually is being remodeled. I heard that we
Thank
were
you.
My first question was, can we change the color scheme? Because I feel like it's sterile, you know? And I think that's what we're doing. We're kind of looking at that. Jamie Leeds is the new president. She's kind of a firecracker.
Who is she?
Jamie is in D.C. She's her restaurants are Hank's Oyster Bar.
Oh, okay.
And Commonwealth is her newer one.
Oh, yeah. I never met her.
I met her back when I worked at Elka when this whole thing started.
Yeah.
And
dear Elka, huh?
Oh, so you were at Elka.
Yeah, I was the pastry chef.
She was the pastry chef.
Way back.
Yeah.
Who is the guy with the red baseball hat?
The young Asian who had studied microbiology or something.
Oh, I think you're talking about Jeff Inohara.
Probably.
Yes.
Yeah. Probably.
What happened to him? He was really good.
He was really good. He went on to do a couple different restaurants, but I think he may be a private chef now.
Wow.
That happens to some unfortunate people.
Yeah. You know? And Elka, miss her too. Got chocolate firecrackers.
I know. Well, and it was just such a fun time. I remember when Nancy Silverton came into that conference,
right?
And she was pregnant with maybe her third kid or something, and she'd driven all of her breads up, and Laura Chanel was just starting to make her cheese, and everybody was there, Mary Sue and Susan, you know, and I think Lydia Shire and Lydia Bastianich were in that first one, and
yeah, but Lydia was
Barbara Chop, of course.
Barbara, yeah.
Yeah, the last time we were in San Francisco, one of the events I met Lydia out for my morning walk. Anne was still in bed. And she said, "Where are you going for lunch today?"
And we went to Slanted Door.
Yeah, we were. I said we're going to Slanted Door. She said, "Oh, I'd love to go there."
So that's what we did.
Can you get us in?
So we had so much fun.
Not only did we get her in, it turned out that the sous chef who was cooking that day, who was a young lady, was a huge fan.
Of
Lydia's.
So we had quite a large lunch.
We had an absolute ball, and it used to be like, and then somehow it wasn't quite the same.
Well, yeah, I mean, I took all the, when we had our meeting, there's a couple things I want to tell you about, but when we had our meeting in Bay Area, we all went out to Bourbon and Branch afterwards, which is a great little kind of speakeasy bar that makes these very wonderful handcrafted cocktails, and you only need a couple of those, you know. And then I said, hey, there's a Vietnamese Chinese restaurant right around the corner from here that makes garlic crab. So, you know, they dredge the crab, pull the crabs out of the tank, dredge them and fry them, and then chop them up and put them in a hot wok with some garlic and galleon, and it's just delicious with garlic noodles, and we just had a feast, you know, and we just had such a fun time. But I was going to tell you, you know, I've also done the scholarship mentor program with WCR for a long time, so I always host, you know, an individual, people want to have a baking and pastry week with me. So we've brought in lots of different people over the years just to come and see how, you know, how our bakery, usually they're so focused on the pastry. I haven't had any men yet, but you can't be a male to be a member of WCR too, you know. You don't have to be a woman.
Right.
But,
and there are male pastry chefs. What's his name? Guas. Guas.
Yeah. D.C. Yeah.
Right. From New Orleans.
Is he in New Orleans? Yeah.
He's from New Orleans, but he's looking for a place in D.C.
But I love that program because we've always brought just different people in, and they really need, you know, they're getting to see if they trailed around with me, they'd be horrified and run the opposite direction because I have to do a lot of the operational business stuff too. And not just kind of decorate cupcakes all day. I think it's a great opportunity for people just to, you know, I know Sherry Yard does that too, and people come and spend a week with her at their empire.
And Nora does in D.C.
Yeah, and it's just great. And I've always keep in touch with a lot of those women, and they kind of grow in the business too, so.
Oh, I love that program. That's really fabulous. Now, spell out the website for WCR. What is it now currently? And give us your website.
If you just Googled Women Chefs and Restaurateurs, it pops up.
Women Chefs and Restaurateurs.
Yeah.
And your website is Citizen Cake? CitizenCake.com.
CitizenCake.com and OrsonSF.com.
Orson, OrsonSF.com.
That's right.
Well, it's very exciting. I hope this all flies, and I'm going to follow it.
Oh, good. Well, I think it's going to be fun. Yeah. We'll keep you posted.
Yeah, maybe we'll stay off to have some bubbly with you tonight.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Yes, thank you.
Bye. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and let's keep moving right along here.
Are we moving right along?
We are. I mean, I'm very excited about our next guest. She was
I'm not quite sure. We caught up with Darina She left the farm and the cookery school for a brief time. She was in New York City. Whether the St. Patrick's Day had anything to do with it, I'm not sure, but that was what we were leading up to when we did the interview, and I think you'll find it absolutely fascinating.
Doreena Allen, are you really called the Julia Child of Ireland?
Well, no, isn't that a wonderful compliment? I have indeed been referred to as the Julia Child of Ireland, and having met Julia and been much encouraged and supported by her, it's a wonderful compliment. But I also quite like being called the Alice Waters of Ireland, too.
Oh, okay, because, yeah, I see Alice has popped up with testimonials and whatnot,
yeah,
endorsements.
Have you ever been to Australia, Doreena?
Oh, indeed I have, absolutely, yes. Oh, yeah.
So did you meet Stephanie Alexander when you were there?
I did, and also lovely Maggie Beers.
Maggie Beers, yeah. Oh, we know them very well. We used to live in Australia.
Yeah, we used to
It's funny how there are so many women who have actually made a difference in food in that sort of way. We cook differently to men, but totally cool. Long live the difference.
I always describe Stephanie Alexander as a combination of Alice Waters and Julia Child.
That's right, yes.
Because
she had such an impact on the way Australians eat, really.
You know, she said something really funny. I'll share this because we talked to her before we were doing the program, and now she seems to be sort of practically retired. She said, it's really nice. When we started our restaurant in Melbourne, she said it was so easy because there was nobody doing what we were doing.
Yes.
So everybody flocked to us.
Yes.
And she said it got to be much too difficult, and now it's much more profitable to write books now. I don't know whether you're finding that or not.
Well, things are really changing, and all over the world there's a growing awareness, and so many young, passionate young chefs and cooks now really respecting ingredients and doing delicious, really creative things with them and really going out of their way to source really good quality produce, and that's all good news. I mean, there's a lot of the other too, but there is this sort of counter-revolution, so to speak, taking place.
Let's back up. I'm going to be talking about this book, The Forgotten Skills of Cooking, The Time-Honored Ways Are the Best, that you wrote. I should, by way of introduction, also point out that you're probably the most fabulous personality, TV personality in Ireland. And the thing that knocked my socks off was that you and your husband co-founded this Ballymaloe cookery school in 1983. In County Cork, Ireland, and it's world famous.
That's right. I mean, I know it's a bit of a stretch for a lot of Americans, particularly to imagine that there could be a cookery school that people come to from all over the world in Ireland, because still the challenge when I come over to America of people sort of imagining that we live on corned beef and cabbage all year round. As wonderful as it is, there's a lot going on. There's a whole renaissance of food and food culture in Ireland, and you know, you can eat so brilliantly.
The produce, your ingredients are just, you talk about pristine waters for seafood. And now, there was an Irish woman who wrote for the Washington Post. Her name was Anne, and I can't remember her last name. And I talked to her early on, early 90s, and she was really the one who told me about this great renaissance in Ireland.
Yeah, not before time, mind you, but I suppose it's been really gathering momentum for the last, certainly maybe 20, 25 years now, and slowly at first, but then like the ripples of water gathers momentum, and now that we have a tremendous artisan food community, who artisan food producers, specialist food producers, and people like cheesemakers, people who cure meat, rare free-range chickens, ducks and geese, and all of that kind of thing, and of course farmers markets as well. I was very much involved in the revival of the farmers markets. We now have, I started the first one after I'd seen the San Francisco market years and years ago, about 14 or 15 years ago, and now I think there are about 160, 170 farmers markets in Ireland, so that's also really vibrant, and they're weekly, and of course we have a wonderful growing climate in Ireland, a long season, so we can have produce the whole year round, really. We just closed for about 2 weeks just after Christmas.
The photography is absolutely stunning in this book. It makes you want to book the next flight.
But as if you hadn't done enough, Doreena, founding this school and creating, you're now into almost your third generation of graduates from the school, I guess.
We started the cooking school on our farm. We have an organic farm, about 100 acres, very close to the sea in East Cork, in east of Cork City, out near Ballycotton. And we started the school on our farm in converted farm buildings in 1983. It was an alternative way of earning a living on the farm, as farming, as horticulture had become more difficult. We decided that we would I loved cooking and that I would teach cooking and pass on my skills. So in the first we had about 8 or 9 students and then 11 and then 18. Now we take 56 students and we have students literally from all over the world at the moment. I think there are 10 nationalities. So, and we do long courses, what you would call a vocational, we call them professional courses, 3 12-week courses a year, then lots and lots of short courses, days, weekends, weeks, or if people are in Ireland, you know, they could come in for an afternoon to the cooking school to have a cooking class. And then we also do these forgotten skills courses, which this book was based on.
Explain what you mean by forgotten skills, of course.
Well, look, I'll tell you what, it's really, in a way, we've had a big wake-up call in Ireland, and indeed you have had it in this country as well. In the last couple of years, as you may know, Ireland was referred to for over 10 years as the Celtic Tiger. Extraordinary growth, economic growth and all of that, prosperity, unprecedented prosperity. And so we sort of, to a great extent, were on one great long party for 10 years. And during that time particularly, but even before that, many young people concentrated on a set of academic skills. We wanted to be lawyers or architects or doctors or dentists or also, you know, all those sort of careers. And there was a sort of general feeling that, you know, why would you bother to learn how to cook, you know, I mean, you could buy it, you know, you'd have the money, you'd buy it. And cooking, and indeed learning how to grow things and keeping a few chickens in your garden, any, those sort of things were all looked on as rather looked down on as sort of secondary skills, of skills of lesser value. But in the last couple of years, things have changed utterly. Many people are in quite changed, different circumstances. They've either lost their jobs or they've had to take a cut in wages. And so suddenly people had a set of academic skills that really served them very well during the boom years and had them riding on the crest of a wave, enormously confident and so on. Suddenly, in changed circumstances, they find that the skill set they had are of no use to them. They have no survival skills. In fact, some of our children's friends, you know, said to me one day, well, I've got to come and learn how to cook and so on. I can scarcely make myself a cup of coffee. And this was a young boy, brilliantly successful hedge fund manager in Amsterdam, and he suddenly was traumatized by the fact that he couldn't do a thing for himself and no longer had the money, because he spent so much during those boom years, nobody thought it would ever end. And so now people are really understanding and appreciating the value of a degree of self-sufficiency. We realize that we mustn't hand over complete power over our... We must re-empower ourselves so that we can actually look after ourselves. And not only for economic reasons, because obviously if you can cook and if you can do lots of those things yourself, well, it costs less money, but also the sheer joy of cooking a meal from start to finish and sharing it with your family and your friends around the kitchen table, for the joy of growing something and waiting for it to be ready to eat it and all of that, or catching a fish or any of those things. People didn't realize that that was such, and that there was so much, that it enhances the experience so much more when you have input into something yourself. So people kept asking for these forgotten skills courses and then for a book to go with it. So it's been really well received. It's gone into its third printing and it's only in the shops since before Christmas. And just won last week in London, it won the kind of Oscars of Cookbook Award, the Andre Simon Award for the best cookbook of 2000.
I can just imagine that. What I can't figure out is how you found a time to write.
You know about everything. How to wash casings for sausages. I mean, I actually have done that, but my son never did.
And you know here in America, there's an absolutely incredible revival of interest in butchery and in making sausages and chorizos, salamis, cured meat, guanciale, all of that.
Yes, our latest stars are not the chefs so much as the butchers now.
Absolutely.
That was a signal event caused you, I think, more than anything, to write this book. So why don't you tell us the butter story?
Oh, indeed, yes. Well, this was the sort of the thing that just got me started, really. Was I was in the cooking school in one of the kitchens, and suddenly I saw a sort of slightly flustered student making a dash for the hen's bucket in the corner. Now, we live, as I said, in the middle of an organic farm, so we also, of course, have hens, and the scraps from the morning's cooking are fed to the hens by the students, in fact, and come back as eggs a few days later. So it's all part of a sort of holistic system. And suddenly I saw this student making a dash for the hen's bucket with something in a bowl. So I'm always interested to see what they're throwing into the hen's buckets, because I always keep saying, you know, your difference between profit and loss in a restaurant can easily be the waste if you're careless about waste.
Sure.
So anyway, I looked in the bowl and I could see that there was cream which had been over whipped and it was sort of beginning to turn into butter. And so I said, don't turn that out. You know, and I said to her, what's wrong? And she said, well, I was whipping the cream and I was trying to get my lunch out at the same time and it's gone all funny. And I said, don't throw it out. you've made butter. That's the butter. She was like completely wide-eyed and said, are you serious? That butter. So anyway, I brought it back
and mixed it
a little bit more and made it into butter, called the other students around. I realized that most of the students in the room hadn't connected cream with butter. So they were completely fascinated and all of that. And so and then several wanted to make butter afterwards. But even if you may not in your busy life decide you want to make your own butter. But on the other hand, if you overwhip cream, then you can make it into butter rather than throwing it out.
Throw it out, right.
Yeah, so I mean, these are all interesting little skills that our parents and grandparents would have, of course, just taken for granted.
I thought the funniest aspect of it was that you were sort of implying that the student didn't know where butter came from, didn't know that butter was made with cream.
Well, she totally didn't. just hadn't connected the fact that butter came from cream.
Really?
Even in Ireland, sadly, we are so unbelievably detached from the reality of how food is produced. Most people buy their food in supermarkets wrapped up in plastic or on little polystyrene trays or something. They never see an animal. They don't even see a garden very much. They don't dig potatoes. So basically, all of these things are a mystery. I mean, I once had a student ask me what kind of... Now, this sounds like utterly amazing, and this is completely true. What kind of... with those little pasta granules called orzo, what kind of tree do they grow on? You just think this is such a joke, but basically she said they were cooking rice, and it looks fairly similar to rice. So how was that person who's completely detached from how things are produced? It wasn't such an amazing question when you think about it, but really there's a lot of that. And it's really shocking, and particularly in our country, to find youngsters who simply don't know how to peel an onion anymore. We must not let... I'm a grandmother now, and I'm really passionate about this whole subject of passing on the inherited wisdom and skills that we've...
Our niece was visiting from England, and we served roasted beets.
Yes.
And she had never, ever seen a whole roasted beet or a whole beet period.
She said, what's that?
See, there you are. I mean, it's not just young people, it's a lot of older people too. So there's a lot of work to be done. And you see, a lot depends on dinner, so to speak. Basically, I was brought up at a time when the unwritten message was, well, if you didn't put your energy into putting, and your money for that matter, into putting really good food that nourished the family onto the table, well, then you would give it to the doctor or the chemist or the pharmacist. And my mother was utterly convinced that our food should be our medicine, and that if she fed us well, that we would be able to have a better chance of resisting disease, we would have more energy, vitality.
And she was right.
She was totally right. No, and that was at a time before everybody had a medicine cabinet with enough stuff to run a field hospital in their houses. You didn't have all these pills and boxes and little jars of vitamin pills and mineral pills and all sorts of things. You just bought really good food, or you grew it, or you bought it from your neighbour. And then there's the other whole point about local food and also season. I mean, when you buy your food from a supermarket, most people have absolutely no way of telling, or there's no hint as to what's in season, basically. And our bodies need the food that's in season at the time. There is no question about that. It's scientifically proven at this stage. And not only that, but nowadays, people, particularly in cities, but even in the country, eat very little local food. Now, nowadays, everything has to be proved scientifically, but I'm absolutely convinced of the importance of eating as much local food as possible, because it's well proven at this stage that if you have hay fever or whatever, and you can manage to get your hands on local honey, it cures it completely. And you see, and the growth in allergies is just phenomenal.
Oh, my grandchildren. I mean, I'm appalled.
I'm convinced, and this, everything has to be proved scientifically nowadays. If you talk about anecdotal evidence, it's sort of almost a joke. But I have no doubt that the growth in allergies is connected to the fact that people are eating food from all over the world now, very often with bacteria and enzymes and all sorts of things, both good and bad, that our systems in a particular different latitude or whatever have never been subjected to. So,
yeah, look at lactose. I mean, this is a perfect example of it, right?
Yes, there is that. I mean, very few people nowadays have access to raw milk or to milk from their area. Milk was the one thing that, if it was raw, it came from, it had to be fresh and it came from your area.
Yeah.
So I battle a lot in Ireland about for the right of people to drink raw or unpasteurized milk if they want to. I mean, if you want to have pasteurized and homogenized milk, you can go into any shop or supermarket anywhere and get it. But those of us who feel very strongly about the importance of having unpasteurized milk, we were all reared on it, for our children and grandchildren and the calcium and all of that that's in it and all of the other enzymes, well, people have a right to have that too if they want it.
Now, you have this book.
Important, yeah.
You have this book.
Yeah, the book is sort of, it starts off, I may not be using the right word here, but the word that springs to mind is a manifesto. You start off with this manifesto that there are these lost skills that people must recapture. But then then you went much beyond that and said, and this is how you actually make food using this set of skills. With 700 recipes. Now, how did you imagine that someone would use the book?
Well, exactly, as it's written, really, because what's happening now is that people are, if they want to make themselves a bit of bacon again, or if they want to make a bit of butter, if they want to learn how to pluck a pheasant or a fillet of fish, or you were talking earlier there about, cooking periwinkles or whatever, they go to this book as a sort of reference book, and it's had an incredible response. Also, it's not just that, it seems to have kind of touched places with people where it's a sort of a nostalgic thing. So there are many, many people who remember a life at that time when they were children or whatever, and suddenly it makes them realize the importance of all of that, and they hadn't, in some cases, they hadn't even properly realized that it was lost and the urgency about saving it.
So if we do it this way, let's suppose you were doing things the way that you think it ought to be done. So you would go today to the farmer's market and you would buy for the next two or three days whatever was the freshest looking stuff there.
Yes.
And then you'd come back and look in the index of the book and say, this is what I got now, this is how Dorina says I can cook this.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that would be good. And also, I hope that it will make people really think about what's in season at the time and use that. And to realize that, there are two other elements of the book that I think the first chapter is on foraging.
I was going to mention there are two things I'd like for you to talk about.
Food in the wild, because a lot of that food, you can forage in cities too, basically a lot of that food has not been mucked around with, to increase the yields and all of that, and it has many, many vitamins, minerals, and trace elements that are certainly not in the very intensively produced food any longer.
But it's a lost art.
They're very, very valuable as an addition to our diet.
We interviewed a forager from the Pacific Northwest, he it's amazing what all he finds to forage. But when I explained to him my method of determining what was going into my salad from my backyard, he was totally appalled, because my method is to taste it and see if it tastes like a weed.
I know.
he said there's poison hemlock all over the place.
There are, but of course there are some poisonous things, and you have to be street savvy, and you can't just go and eat anything you see. But you want a good book with a lot of good illustrations and so on in it. But on the other hand, you'd be surprised how many plants really are edible, actually. Much more than aren't, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
I was really interested in the foraging section of the book. Everybody thinks of foraged items going into a salad, but I'd never before thought of putting foraged greens into a soup.
There's
a picture of this fabulous dark green coloured soup.
At this time of year, quite soon now, we'll be making nettle soup, we'll be making lots of watercress soup at this time of year. We'll have Alexander's quite soon, and then morel. So you can forage, well, in Ireland particularly, we have a terrific growing climate, a long growing climate, and we can forage pretty much the whole year round.
Yeah, and you have a whole section on growing your own, and another section on preserving.
That's the other thing. I mean, you were mentioning earlier that you have quite a short growing season in the area that you're in there. Well, that's the other really important thing, is to be able to have the skills to preserve the food when it is in plentiful in the summer and so on, so that you have delicious things to eat during the winter. And also, that's all about thrifty housekeeping. The whole skill of thrifty housekeeping had almost disappeared. And my God, had we started, you know, people, waste has become a way of life. When I was a child, you get a clip in the ear if you left anything on your plate at lunchtime or whatever. But now, you know, now it's become completely acceptable to waste. And in Ireland, they say that 30% of all of the food that's bought, I don't know whether it's changed now in the last year or two since we're getting a bit more hard up, but 30% of all the food that was bought literally went in the bin, and most people don't have chicken. So what are we like? We were always brought up to think that that was unlucky and that we simply must not waste. So I think that's another skill that's forgotten, and that's that the skill of thrifty housekeeping, and it's underappreciated, and actually in many cases people simply don't know how to cook thriftily and to use up less expensive cuts of meat and all of that in a delicious way.
Right.
Well, but the message is coming through in pieces. I don't think we've seen a book that has so much of it in one place.
Thank you.
I mean, you are to be congratulated.
Thank you.
Not only of bringing back time-honored ways, but also of really putting a message through about how you can cook almost everything.
That's good.
Is there anything you left out?
I could have gone on and on. It was a year late, and it was over twice the size it was commissioned by my poor, unfortunate publisher, Kyle Katie. So she said to me, if you don't get it in soon, you can keep it.
Oh, dear.
And so basically, I had to get it into her, but there really is lots and lots more that I could add to it. And I still have more things, so maybe if she does a revised edition in a couple of years' time, I can add some more things to it. But anyway, I hope you're going to come to Ireland, because there's so much going on in the whole food scene in Ireland, and many, many good restaurants and wonderful, wonderful producers that you can go and visit on the farms.
And what's a good time of the year?
Tourism thing starting. Pardon?
What would be a good time of the year to come?
Well, you know, it's good to come when the weather's slightly, not that you can ever depend on the weather nowadays, but from any time from May onwards, May to, you know, October is really nice. And so that's the late spring and summer, and then going into the early autumn. That's a lovely, lovely time of the year. The countryside looks completely beautiful, and we have, as I said, wonderful produce.
And everything is very green.
Oh my goodness, we can grow grass like nowhere. Many of our best foods come from our grass, our dairy products. You know, I know you can, over here in America, you can get Irish butter. It comes over,
yes,
I think, under the Kerrygold brand, and it's really, I mean, Irish butter is wonderful because of our grass, and our beef, of course, and our lamb. Many of our best foods come from our grass, and then, of course, we have a lot of wonderful fish, too.
Well,
the whole food tourism thing is now beginning to take off in Ireland. There's an organisation called Good Food Ireland that links up. You can actually Google that, and I think it's goodfoodireland.ie or .com or something. And you can, you know, literally, if people are interested in food, can go around from one place to another. You can visit the butchers, the bakers, go to the restaurants that are serving local food, all that kind of thing. So that's a very good source of information, too.
Well, look for us, because we're going to make this trip.
I wanted, before we sign off here, I wanted to get Dorina to volunteer that she would help us with our planning for this trip to Ireland.
I'd be delighted to. And for anybody else coming to Ireland, if they just get onto the discoverireland.com website as well. There's an enormous amount of information there, but I'm very happy to help you. And also, if any of your listeners are coming to Ireland, just to say to them that at the cooking school, which is in Shanagarry in East Cork, we have cooking classes almost every day, so people, if they're coming on a holiday to Ireland and don't necessarily want to do a longish course, they could just pop in for an afternoon, and the school is in the middle of a little organic farm, and we'll be there with a big wide welcome for them.
Sounds wonderful.
Let's just sign off for those listeners who are still with us, and if not, we'll just make them go to the end of the interview anyway. You have a website, no doubt.
We have a website, www.cookingisfun.ie.
Dorina, thank you so much. You've been an absolute breath of fresh air into our program, and we're delighted to talk to you.
Well, I look forward to welcoming you to Ballymaloe in Ireland.
Oh, thanks. I've been dreaming about it. Thanks, Dorina.
And then happy St. Patrick's Day.
And you too.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.
And it's time now to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again, and moving again on. We have our next guest.
Hold
absolutely.
Hold on a second. Let's do the thing about electronic communication from you, the listeners, to us, from our homepage via Facebook or a blog response or through Twitter, which Anne spends a lot of time on and loves to hear from you. You can do it with a single click right from the homepage, and we look forward to hearing from you. And back to you, dear.
Yeah, and I think you just said it right. Our next guest is so coolly professional, or so professionally cool, I guess we might say, that she's always a delight. She's always prepared. She's always right on top of everything. And she's an old buddy of yours as well, right?
She sure is. And what Monty Old doesn't know about wine probably isn't worth knowing. And she put together this beautiful little book called Wine Secrets, which you're going to want to own. But first of all, let's hear what she had to say about it.
Monty Old.
Yes.
Welcome to On the Menu for the third time.
Thank you for having me.
This puts you in extraordinarily select company, I should tell you.
Yeah,
and
Thomas Keller.
I think Thomas might be on four already, but he's always up to something new, and Marnie's always up to something new as well, which is why we invited her to join the program together, because somewhere, I think it was in Wine Enthusiast magazine, there was a wonderful page of books about wine, and I marked on there, these are books that I want, and Anne sent off for Wine Secrets, and we got our copy, and we've been reading it. The first thing I have to say about mine is it's so eminently sensible.
Well, thank you. I tried to, in crafting that book and coming up with the topics that would be addressed, it's a compilation of essentially interviews with 40 top experts in the business sharing simple and common sense advice for entry-level wine drinkers, folks who aren't necessarily looking to become experts, but who would feel more comfortable with a little bit more of a sense of how the wine world works.
Yeah, so let's quickly point out that for our wine aficionado friends, like Dr. Bob and all the guys we used to taste with at Dreadnought Wines. What's Greg Godless' place? I forgot. Gateway Wines.
Gateway.
This book is not for you. You'll say, I already know that. But this is a book that has about 180 action-packed pages filled with information that most wine drinkers won't know.
Well, and I would say, too, that I've had comments from those who've been around the business for quite some time, either collectors or folks in the trade or in the industry, in the hospitality profession, who've found great nuggets of information in there as well. I had a wonderful conversation a few days ago with a group of collectors who were shocked to read that you could freeze open wine and return to it a few days later, and that was in fact a better way to preserve its flavors than using those vacuum pumps systems or anything like that. And I think that provided a great opportunity for people who do like to sample different wines to think about it a little differently.
I think it's a stunner. I mean, I would think that anything having to do with alcohol, you shouldn't freeze anyhow.
Well, it doesn't freeze real well anyway.
Well, and it's true that a thin layer of alcohol does separate and sort of float freely above the frozen
block. Is that what happens?
And what ends up happening is that there are a few limitations to that. I was actually thrilled to get that piece of advice, and it came from Ron Wygand in California, who's one of the only people on the planet who holds both the Master Sommelier and Master of Wine certification. So he knows his stuff. And he told me that for almost 20 years now, he has been exploring the possibilities of freezing open wine, and that he's found a few limitations, that you shouldn't freeze mature wine, so wine's over 10 years old, drink them up when you pull the cork, and that you do need to keep the wines upright so that layer of alcohol that floats to the surface doesn't corrode away at the cork and pull those woody flavors into the wine. But other than that, it's amazing how well freezing preserves the flavor, and I've been very happy to be able to share that little nugget, that useful tip in the book.
I'm going to put a useful nugget of ours beside that. You probably knew this anyway, but we learned this from a sommelier at a out of the way hotel in the Basilicata region of Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted white wine, but we wanted to chill really fast. So most people's reaction would be to fill the bucket with a massive quantity of ice and stick the bottle in it. And he did more than that. He also filled it with water.
Of course, yeah.
So there you know, because what that does is that brings the close to freezing liquid in contact with more of the bottle.
Of the surface of the bottle. So and that's what's important, yes. And in fact, if you're really impatient, having that mix of ice water first off come up as high in the neck of the bottle as you possibly can to submerge as much of the bottle as possible. But another way to speed the process up is actually to spin the bottle in the ice, because that mixes up the liquid inside and circulates the warmest wine in the center out to the surface of the glass and back.
You know, it's funny, we have a wine cooler that incorporates putting in water and ice in a regular large wine bucket. Seems like it works
just fine.
I don't think we've ever used it.
I don't think we've ever used it either. We decided we must have one.
Somebody sent it to us. We didn't buy it.
Some of the state liquor control board stores actually have relatively instant wine chillers in them, but I haven't seen one of those for a long time. And the main one that we go to, specialty collection store we go to near to our house, doesn't have that facility. I wanted to pick out two things that I thought were among the best things that I read, and then so we can talk about them, and then we'll go on to some of your gems, because I certainly don't remember all of them. Your one suggestion is to take wine shopping very seriously and to trust your wine purveyor, and I thought that was very interesting. You said that even you don't have to go to someone with the largest number of wines in their stock. In fact, you might be better off doing the reverse, but you want to trust your wine shop, and you want to go to one where they know your taste so that they can recommend things, because they're going to know the values they have and the wines that they think are the best in their collection, because after all, they selected them to put them in stock.
Well, I think the very important part of that, and the thing that many people hesitate to do when wine shopping, even though they might do it shopping for something else, is the idea of speaking to or asking for assistance. And there's a natural reluctance to put your buying decision in someone else's hands. And I completely understand that. In the consumer culture that we have these days, we're used to plucking items off the shelf in the grocery store or off the rack in the clothing store ourselves. But in wine, it is a frustrating item to shop for, in the sense that the bottles all look the same and give you information on the label that refers more to ingredients and provenance and less to style and flavor. And so that does make it harder for your average consumer to look at the labels and identify the wines that are most likely to suit their personal taste. And I don't want to give the impression that there's some objective, complete, independent idea of what a good wine is. What I mean about talking to the retailer and speaking to the clerk or to the buyer or whoever is there to assist customers is that they are aware of a spectrum of style within their offerings and can ask you a few questions to help identify. Even if they haven't spoken to you before, they can help figure out which end of the style spectrum is best going to suit you. Our tastes in wine are as varied and different as differing tastes in music or fashion or art. So any store needs to have a wide range of options, and the person best qualified, the person who most knows which wine suits which taste, is the person behind the counter.
Right, and I think we in several of the interviews, the sommeliers you interviewed made it very clear that they thought that relying on them to select the right wines in a restaurant was absolutely the correct thing to do, and it is something we do almost all the time, because after all, they know what's on their list, they know the sweet spots, they know they've sampled all of the wines, and as a result, they're an ally. They're not someone who's trying to sell you something more expensive than you
want. And there are ways to convey that ballpark of what you're looking for. First off, there's no reason that you should ever cede control over your price range to the salesperson or to the sommelier.
Right.
There are very easy ways to communicate what budget you're shopping in. And in a restaurant circumstance, if you're uncomfortable verbalizing your budget, you can always do something simple that I recommend, pointing to a price on a wine list, for example, and saying, I'm looking for something like this. Gives a very clear message without bringing up the uncomfortable social topic of prices in front of your guests.
Yeah, I think that's great. You must know David Lynch, who was at Babbo and is now at Quince in San Francisco.
Yes.
And he not only served as wine one evening, he also acted as our waiter, since I hadn't decided he must be one.
It was good. Yeah.
And he was very nice about that. But I had selected a wine, and I said I thought this was really nice and would go with what we were having. It was a white wine from Campania.
Mm-hmm.
No, not nearly as well respected as the wines should be from that region. And I said, I thought I'd selected this one, but I said, if you have another suggestion, by all means, So he suggested another wine from the same region, and it was at least 10% less expensive.
And the other thing I would say is not only to feel comfortable bringing up matters of budget, but also it's tremendously useful to the retailer or to the restaurateur or sommelier, whichever of those people you're speaking to about wine selection, to give an example, as you did in that instance, of a style that you enjoy. Because as a sommelier, if someone tells me I normally drink French Sancerre, but I'm looking to try something else tonight, it gives me a huge amount of information about their personal taste.
Right. Well, you've picked one of our favorite white wines from France anyway. And
the other issue, though, that I could speak to Maureen about is frequently when we turn over the pairing to the sommelier, we end up with some sake,
Some beers and cocktails, I'm sure.
Yes, I mean, we've been served cocktails with a course.
Mm-hmm. Did you see the article by Frank Bruni about a meal that he had with Aldo Somme at La Bernardin? I thought that was really terrific. And Aldo outdid him by serving. He served a bourbon with one course and a beer with another.
Yeah. He's good. We've interviewed him.
Yeah, again. He's absolutely wonderful. We had a wonderful time with him.
It's true that the goal for the modern sommelier is a little different than the stereotype that many of us think of the sort of opinionated sommelier foisting their judgment and their choices upon diners. That really isn't the way the hospitality industry works these days. And most wine professionals understand that their purpose is to make the guest happy at the end of the day. And that means finding not only a wine that doesn't hurt too much on the pocketbook, that's in the right budget, but something that's designed to suit that person's taste. I'll never forget, I used to work at a very fancy restaurant in Philadelphia. I mean, we're talking $40-$50 entrees.
Yeah.
This was an expense account kind of place. But occasionally we would have a diner come in and ask for something that was not represented on our menu. I'm thinking of a particular couple that would come in once a year. They loved it, but it was clear that we were beyond their normal budget for dining out. And the husband was so shy, it took me a few visits before he spoke up and really told me what he wanted. And he said, I always drink cocktails in your restaurant because the only wine I like is sweet red.
Oh, geez.
And he's absolutely correct that most restaurants, certainly fine dining restaurants, don't offer sweet reds on their wine list. But I told him, there's nothing wrong with that. Just remind me next time you're here. And he did. And when he came in, I served him one of our red wines by the glass with a healthy splash of port from behind the bar. And you know, I had such a big smile on his face. He was so happy. And
Marnie, that's disgusting.
It is not.
I think that's quite brilliant.
It's ingenious, but I wouldn't be caught dead drinking it.
I have to tell you a little story.
And of course, it's, I don't have
a sleep. It's a story about someone whose name I will not reveal.
Mm-hmm.
But we were at the fanciest restaurant in Madrid, Spain, where the service was stiff, to say the least. And the sommelier was in full uniform, including this thing dangling from around his neck that was sort of like a spoon. And he opened our wine, and then he poured a little bit into his sampling thing and answered, "Why is he drinking our wine?" Oh, oops, I let the word out. Oh, dear. That was the restaurant where we could hear the people at the next table grumbling. They were they were Americans, and they were grumbling about something. And I said, "I bet they're grumbling about the fact that we're smoking between courses," which we did then.
Yeah. So we haven't for many years.
We called the waiter over, and we said, "If these people really object, we won't mind at all, and we'll just stop." And he said, "No." He said, "They can sit there and put up with it, or they can go sit somewhere else."
Well, it's quite different in Europe now, too.
I'm just going to pick on one other piece of what I thought was really good advice in the book, and then Marty, I'll ask you to pick maybe one of the things that you think people find most useful, and then all we'll do is say, if you want to know more, you just have to buy the book called Wine Secrets, because you have no excuse. We can't possibly cover it all on the air.
Of course.
So the section that I really liked was the contributor who wrote that you get much better value for money if you select less well-known wines, and that has the You know, it has the value that you get additional value for money because the price isn't being chased by more people being interested in it. But also, you might have a fascinating new experience as well and learn about a new wine region that you otherwise wouldn't.
And that's absolutely true. This is, as a sommelier or a restaurant buyer or even a retail buyer, one of the things that we encounter is that more and more regions around the world are beginning to apply the lessons of fine winemaking region to different grape varieties around the world in places where we had never tried to make more than average Joe type wines, and the results are really remarkable. But it does take quite a long time for a new region or a new grape variety to earn its stripes in terms of credibility from the consuming public. And the way that they have to go about doing that is introducing their product at modest prices before people can ever really be willing to pay something closer to the standard for a premium famous grape like Pinot Noir or Chardonnay.
Right, so if it was something like 100% Carmenere from Chile, that might fit into that category.
Absolutely.
Can you think of one that you think is particularly good right now?
Oh, certainly. I'm really impressed with the premium quality Chenin Blancs emerging from South Africa at the moment.
Okay.
There's some tremendous range there. The lower end wines tend to be lighter bodied, almost in that Vouvray style with a hint of sweetness. But if you see one whose alcohol content is over 14%, they're more likely to be barrel fermented, rich, opulent, and toasty, more like a full bodied Chardonnay.
We'll have to explore that track before everybody else listens to the program and buys it all.
And I'm having a hard time finding better values in the red wine world right now than Garnacha from Spain. It does sound like the word Grenache, the French name for the grape of Châteauneuf-du-Pape and Côte du Rhône for a reason. It is the same grape, but it actually originates from Spain. And there, the entire northeastern part of the country grows it to various degrees, and you'll find great quaffable bargains from appellations like Campo de Borja at only, you know, $5 to $10 a bottle. Great value. But there are also premium versions a little higher up in altitude in that Aragon region. There are appellations like Calatayud where you don't have to pay very much to get world class, low yield concentration in the Garnacha that is worthy of that Châteauneuf-du-Pape class at usually about a third of the price.
Now, we were just in Valencia in Spain last fall, and we went to a region, essentially the Valencia DOC, even though it's a little bit out of the city, and we had a wine made from grape called Monastrell, which, of course, we also know as Mouvedre and called Mataro in the United States.
Yes.
And that was also very surprising and a very good price point. But let's conclude the interview, Maya, if we can, by, you know, what's your top suggestion out of all the recommendations in the book? Which one would you most like people to know about?
The biggest suggestion.
Well, I think I'd like to come back to the concept of pairing wine with food for that one, because it really is, at the end of the day, the thing that most people who want to learn something about wine, their motivation is not so much that they want to memorize the names of regions in countries they've never visited or understand the chemistry behind fermentation or sensory analysis. What they really want to feel more comfortable doing is choosing wines that are most appropriate and most flattering to the kinds of foods that they eat on a regular basis. And there's a lovely chapter in there where I interview a famous importer named Terry Thies, and he gives such fascinating and witty advice about something that sommeliers know and that most wine drinkers don't get a chance to learn for quite some time. And that is that while it's tempting to appreciate intensity in a wine as the be-all and end-all of its potential quality, the reality is that wine really isn't designed to be the centerpiece of a meal. It's designed to be the accent. There's a reason that we call drinks refreshments. They're to provide counterpoint on the palate. And he has a lovely chapter about how drinking lighter-bodied wine, medium and light-bodied wines within the white and red, rosé, and sparkling realm can, number one, get you more flattering food partnership, but can also save you money at the end of the day because those wines rarely get the accolades, attention, and supply and demand driven push in pricing that we see with some of the big, big monsters.
like Screaming Eagle and Allen Family and all of those wonderful things that weren't designed to go with food anyway.
Exactly.
Marty, we could talk to you all day. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. I believe that you're going to be coming to our home city of Pittsburgh in May for the Pittsburgh Wine Festival, so we hope we'll see you there.
Yes.
If not, in the meantime, keep up the great work, and if anything else is happening in your world that you think On the Menu ought to know about, please be sure to get in touch.
I will let you know. And thank you so much for being kind enough to give me a chance to profile Wine Secrets. It's been received very well, and it's thanks to people like you.
And the subtitle is Advice from Winemakers, Sommeliers, and Connoisseurs, and they're fascinating people collected as well, Marnie.
Well, thanks.
Well, thank you. Talk to you soon.
It's been lovely to see you guys again, and I'm sure we'll catch up another time soon.
And we're sure we'll catch up with Marnie another time soon as well. Pittsburgh Wine Festival, if not before. And that's all for this week, I think.
Right. So until next week.
So co-host Ann, what
same
about...
Same time, same...
Place.
Bye-bye.